Today is Sunday. It is March 26th, 2023. This is part 5 of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Richard Tick Segerbloom. Richard spells his, actually Tick spells his last name S-E-G-E-R-B-L-O-M. And my name is Tom Martin. Good afternoon, Tick. How are you today?
Very good, thank you.
Great. May we have your permission to record this oral history over the phone?
Yes.
Thank you. Let's see. Last time, after we finished the interview, we talked a little bit about what we were going to talk about this time, and you mentioned something about the Belknaps in the 1970s you wanted to mention.
You know, I don't recall what that was.
Okay. I wonder if it was about maybe Loewy or John Evans or about
yeah,
their...
Well, before I went to law school, I was working for them, and I think we went through this as far as he was partners with what's his name, Ron Smith.
Right.
So I was doing the rivers, and the last summer I spent was based out of Green River, Utah.
Did you know that Bill was working on his river guide, the river guides, the Belknap river guides, which became very popular.
Yeah, actually, the first trip I took back in probably 68 or 69, I think they already had the original guide.
Okay.
Buzz had done. And then they expanded, so they did, I think, Cataract, and then they did... probably Yampa or the Door, and then I know they did one in Desolation.
Right, Desolation of Great Canyon, Grand Canyon.
Yeah, and I was in, had a picture of me, I think, at least in the Desolation one.
Okay. Cool. Well, last time we'd gotten up to... you'd been appointed by Governor Bryan in the 1980s to serve on this Colorado River Commission. And then at one point you met John Weisheit, and John spells his last name W-E-I-S-H-E-I-T. Was that right? Did you meet John in the 1980s, or was that later?
No, that wouldn't have been until I was in the legislature.
Okay.
I was trying to remember how that happened. It seems to me it may have even been through you. You reached out to my sister to do something and somehow or other.
I remember when we talked about the 1963 river trip some years ago, I think I might have mentioned John. Then let's back up even further than that. When did you get into the legislature?
I was elected in 2006.
Okay. So I'm assuming that before you ran for legislature, you were working your own practice and you were doing this unique law about sexual harassment.
Right. I was not that active. That particular time, I was not that active in politics.
What made you decide to get back into politics?
I think my mother had lost a couple of times, and so she was no longer running. So at that point, I felt like I could. And then the district where I lived, the person who had been there a long time was leaving, so it was a vacant seat. And so it was just, you know, these seats don't come up very often, so I just threw my hat in and ran.
Okay. And that was in 2006?
Correct.
Yeah.
For the State Assembly. And then I was elected 2006, 2008, and 2010, and for the state assembly. And then in 2012, I ran for the state senate. And I think it was probably 2013's legislative session that I met John.
Okay, so let's back up a little bit. So in Nevada, I mean, I'm thinking that state politics typically has a House and a Senate. And so in Nevada, it's called the State Assembly is kind of the equivalent of the House.
State Assembly is the House and the State Senate is the Senate.
Okay. All right. And where was your district in 2006? What were you running?
It's basically what we call Old Las Vegas, downtown Las Vegas.
Okay. So not the new strip.
No, it had a little bit of the strip, but what you would call Old Las Vegas.
Okay. And what did you have to do for that campaign to win?
Basically, you know, go out and walk and knock on doors and stuff. It's a very heavily Democratic district, so when you win the primary, then you win.
Okay.
You don't have to worry about November. And the only thing I remember about that was that back then the primary was in August, so it was being running around walking door to door in August was hot.
I bet it was. And people wouldn't necessarily want to stand and talk to you because that hot air would be coming in their cool house.
Yeah.
Huh. Back in 2006, do you remember what the issues were that were concerning people?
I don't.
Okay.
But it's always the same. In the Democratic district, it's always the same thing. You know?
Okay.
Unemployment and all the basics.
All right.
Survival.
Yeah. Yeah, jobs and economy. Yeah.
Healthcare.
Okay, so these are two-year terms?
Correct.
And when does the legislature, the state assembly, when does it meet?
It meets every other year after the state. So you're elected in November, and then you go to Carson City in February for 4 months.
Okay. For 4 months. How does that work? You mean the nothing happens for as far as legislation is concerned for most of the year? Well, it'd be for 12?
20 months of the 2 year cycle, you don't do anything other than campaign.
Run that past me. Why that's a good governance idea?
It's not, but it goes back to the days, you know, when we were first a state and you know had 10,000 people, or whatever. So it's not conducive to good government anymore because you're supposed to pass a budget for 2 years, and yeah, it's just
wow,
just a relic. But the hotels, which kind of control everything, don't want a full-time legislature because then we get in trouble.
What do you mean, get in trouble?
Well, we might try to actually do something to them. You know, make them pay taxes or do something like that.
Okay. This is, I'm starting to learn something about the power of the what would be the gambling industry there in Nevada?
Yeah, we're one industry, and they pretty much are used to running the show.
Okay. Do you think that'll ever change?
Probably not in my lifetime.
Okay. All right. So what would you do in those 4 months?
You go to Carson City, you live, it's actually like going to college. It's the most fun you'd ever have. Yeah, it was like you live in a hotel, so it's like they live in a dorm. I tell people the only difference between that and going to college is when you go to the bar, the lobbyists pick up your tab so you don't have to pay the bills.
Oh, my gosh. All right. And so I'm thinking that there's going to be committees and there's going to be committee assignments and there's going to be legislation introduced and the committee's going to have to kind of kick it around and see if they want to pass it forward. I mean,
it goes to a committee, the committee passes it, then it goes to the full floor of the Assembly of the Senate, and they pass it, and it goes to the Senate. The Senate has a committee, they vote on it. If they pass it, then it goes to the floor of the Senate, they pass it. Then it's usually been modified, so then the two versions have to meet. The Assembly and the Senate have a special little meeting of probably six people or something, and they decide whether they want to, how to make the bill the same.
Mm-hmm.
Then that bill, if they agree on something, that bill is voted on by both the Assembly and the Senate again.
Oh, wow. Okay. All right.
So to pass a bill is a lot of work.
Yeah, sure sounds like it. Huh. And so, with 4 months, how do y'all streamline stuff? How do you make sure that you can actually get something done in 4 months?
Well, there's a lot, two of the other 20 months, there's a lot of work being done to get things ready.
Okay.
There's a really professional staff that does most of the work. So it's, and the big stuff is, the governor has already ready to go. So it's,
okay.
We basically rubber stamp what the governor wants. But there are some things that we do that we just do on our own.
Okay. So it's a matter of, it's not that you can't all confer, the committees can't confer, they can't look at legislation and say, okay, when this comes up at the next assembly, what do you think about this? Is this something we want to entertain? So in a way, you can actually get some stuff done.
Oh yeah, I mean, you work, just you're not paid, so you have a regular job during the interim.
Okay. So. And that's got to be tough for some of the legislative members who,
especially the Democrats.
Yeah, have to keep their day jobs going, and participate in the assembly.
Yeah, and then run for election.
Okay.
So.
Right.
That, I mean, if depending on what kind of seat you have, it can be. A lot of work just to get reelected.
Okay. Sounds like a quite the commitment then. And it's funny because it's only a 2-year term. That means, you're really busy for 4 months, and then you got to go out and campaign again. I see what you're saying.
Yeah. Hmm. And when you're in Carson City, you get paid $150 a day for the first 60 days, but you work 120 days. So it's a strange. Strange thing.
Run that past me again. You get paid for 160 days?
No, you get paid for 60.
60 days.
The term, you get paid $150 a day for the first 60 days, including weekends, but then you have to work 120 days, and the second 60 days you're not paid.
Who thought up that bright idea?
Again, it goes way back, but everyone's afraid to try to raise their salary because then that's going to be used against you when it runs for re-election.
So. Yep, well, there is that. Yeah, huh. Very fascinating. Were there some pieces of legislation that you got through that you were proud of, that you remember?
Nothing big I recall. My claim to fame is after I got to the Senate, I passed the marijuana bill. That's where I...
Okay.
That's my legacy.
And so that was 2013, 2012, is that right?
2013, yeah.
Okay. Was that for the same district, or was that for a different district?
It's a state senate, so it's twice the size, but the same area, just a little bit bigger.
All right. And like the U.S. House and Senate, are there more assemblymen and less senators?
Yeah, there's 42 assembly and 21 senators.
Okay. And being cautious about this, of which I know very, very little, in the U.S. Senate, there's at least there's a presentation of collegiality and working together. And in the House, it's us versus them. How did that play out in Nevada?
Kind of the same. I mean, most things are unanimous, frankly. But when it comes to controversial, then it's usually D's against the R's. And, when but then the governor can veto something. So the key is, can you get the governor on board? Or if not, you have to have 2/3. And usually you don't have 2/3 because there's more than a third that are Republicans.
Got it.
So, it's a lot. Anything really dramatic doesn't happen because if you get it through the legislature, the governor's going to veto it. And to pass a tax takes a 2/3 vote to begin with. So.
Okay. All right, so some interesting constraints there. In this, does the Senate have the same constraints? You're going to meet 4 months every 2 years?
Yeah. You meet simultaneously.
Okay.
They just don't have to run. They run every 4 years.
So. Oh, how's that work?
Well, that's just that they're senators. They're important.
Yeah, but that means that nothing happens in that middle.
No, they just don't have to run for election. They're still elected.
Oh, I'm sorry. They don't have to run for election. Got it. I misunderstood. I'm sorry about that.
Yeah.
All right, but it's a 4-year term. Got it.
Right.
Okay. And how long, let's see, that's 2013. How long have you been in the Senate then?
Well, I was in the Senate from 2002, and I left in 2018,
okay.
So 6 years. So I was elected twice.
Okay.
And there's also term limits, so you can only serve in the Assembly 12 years and only serve in the Senate for 12 years, so 3 terms. 6 okay. terms in the Assembly and 3 terms in the Senate.
Okay. Well, that what do you think, having been in the Assembly and the Senate, what are your thoughts on term limits?
It basically gives power to the lobbyists and to the staff. I mean, especially when you only meet every other year for 4 months.
Okay.
You know, it takes a long time to learn what you're doing, and by that time, you're almost term limited out. So it's really
interesting.
Makes the politicians much less independent.
I would never have suspected that. Fascinating. So let's talk about the legislation you're actually proud of and known for, which was the legalization of marijuana. When did that first come up for the legislature? Do you recall that?
Well, it was actually passed by the voters. Medical marijuana was passed by the voters, I think, in 2000. So, but there was never any structure for where you could grow and sell it.
Okay.
So you could have a couple of plants yourself, but that was it. So it was legal, but you couldn't do anything. There's no way you could actually go out and buy it. So
okay.
That's what I did, was I created a system where you could, regulate a system that where you could grow it and sell it and buy it.
How did you get, did you use other legislative frameworks from other states for that? How did you come up with that?
Yeah, we basically modeled ourselves after Arizona.
Okay.
It was in turn modeled after kind of Colorado. So it was kind of a hybrid of Colorado and Arizona.
Okay. And when did that go to the legislature for a vote and the governor's review?
2013.
All right. So you got on that pretty fast.
Well, that was 8 years. I mean, that was my fourth term, so it wasn't that fast.
Had you been working on that in the Assembly then?
Not very much. I mean, it was one of those things where the leadership didn't want to really touch it, so it was. We talked about it, but no one ever really pushed it.
Okay.
It was considered to be, a taboo thing, or very negative.
Well, why was it considered that way? Since the citizens of the state clearly passed it, or clearly
well,
wanted
that's
it.
A good question. Just people, politicians were afraid of their shadow, and and basically that's what I proved. Is the reality is people loved it.
Okay.
And, politicians are way behind the curve as far as, but that's true everywhere as far as marijuana goes. I mean, the public is already there.
Okay. And so 10 years now after the passage of that legislation, looking back, is there anything you'd have done different on that?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we basically sat down and just thought about the best way to do it, and in retrospect, there's lots of changes we're going to make, but at the time we did an actually pretty good job. So
okay,
all things considered, it was a pretty good bill.
Yeah, I mean that was sort of cutting edge just 10 years ago, And I think, you know, as things get in place, we start learning things, what works, what doesn't work, what's better, who's got a better mousetrap. So legislation constantly needs to be worked on, but...
Yeah, that's the point. You do the best you can, and then you keep tweaking it.
Yeah, okay. All right, so now let's spin around to thinking about the water in the river. There's a reservoir in northeastern Arizona formed by the Glen Canyon Dam, and the water that comes out of that dam crosses Arizona and flows into the reservoir behind Hoover Dam, right next to Las Vegas. And at what point did you get a sense that maybe all this dam engineering, which happened, started to really get going in the late 1800s, early 1900s, and kind of cranked on through to the 1960s, wasn't quite all it was cracked up to be?
Well, I know, you know, going back to the 70s, that it never should have happened. I didn't fully appreciate, you know, how much less water we had than we needed. But you know, but it was one of those things where you talk about it, and it'd be great to, you know, monkey wrench gang and get rid of the dam. But truly, I didn't really focus on it until I met John and saw that there was actually an active campaign to get rid of it. I thought, wow, this is fantastic.
Okay. And of course, one state's vision of what is fantastic is another state's nightmare, meaning I can see the legislature in California and the legislature in Utah. I think on the federal level, didn't Utah... passed legislation that said decommissioning of Glen Canyon Dam will not be even entertained.
I wouldn't doubt it. I mean, the truth is, for the three southern states, it's good, but for the rest of the states, it's not good in a sense. But the truth is, it never should have been built, and there's really no purpose to it. All it does is, I guess the best thing you could say about it in Colorado, it enables them to take it across the Continental Divide and use it in Denver, but otherwise...
Right. And you know, Colorado, it does get Front Range water.
Yeah, but otherwise, there was never enough water for two major reservoirs.
Right.
And people knew it, the worst part is people knew it at the time. Basically didn't say it.
That's right. Yeah. How do you see, given the current drought, now we've got a nice winter this year with a good amount of water, and everybody's kind of happy thinking, oh, well, we're home free now. How do you see, I guess, what's your vision of how to manage the Colorado River water for the population we have? Not even talking about the population in the future.
Well, the reality is, it's not healthy to have water taken out of the basin. And so first off, we've got to stop water going over to Denver. But then after that, you know, as much water as we can let, you know, go down the river and ideally even go to the ocean, the better. And if you can't get to the ocean, at least the longer you can keep as much water as possible in the river until it gets way down to the bottom of California, that's the best. But, there's certainly, no excuse to have that dam right above the Grand Canyon, which is, first off, you're destroying Glen Canyon, which is a ultimate natural wonder, and then you're also destroying the environment in the Grand Canyon, which is a second ultimate natural wonder. So,
right.
It's horrific, frankly. But it was a great idea to think about trying to get rid of the dam, but I don't think anyone thought it would, the reality would be that Mother Nature would force us to get rid of the dam so soon.
Hmm. Right, and I think the Reclamation has just recently admitted that there's only 40 more years left in the life of Glen Canyon Dam. And that's not a long time.
That's what's so crazy. I mean, the thought that either dam, frankly, the fact that they would build these big lakes knowing that the sediment is going to, you know, in even 1,000 years destroy there. I mean, that is so short term given the history of the world. It's just man's arrogance is just pretty overwhelming.
Yeah, and it's almost made an insurmountable problem because the reservoirs are being impacted by sediment. And our population has grown and grown on this myth of having surplus water. So now what do we do?
Yeah, well, hopefully we start to appreciate water and the natural flow of water and rivers as part of healthy environment, healthy world, healthy mind.
Right. Yeah, it sort of reminds me of the Dolores River in western Colorado there, which has hardly any water in it for in-stream flows, just for the health of the river. Do you see there will be a time when the whole concept of first in line, first in use begins to change?
No, absolutely. And that's the whole point. We just have to go back and rethink both the Colorado River Compact and then the whole concept of water rights and develop a system which encourages conservation but also encourages not using it at all. And again, the farther down river that can take place, the best by far, because it's not healthy for any of us to have these regulated flows through the Grand through Glen Canyon and Grand Canyon.
Right.
Even Hoover Dam could have to be built, it could have been built much smaller but there, starting one thing, first things first, and Glen Canyon Dam is definitely on the way out.
Right. And I know that growing up, you would have been very aware of the sediments, which you would have seen in the upper reservoir when the reservoir was low, right there in Lake Mead. So that's something you would have seen in your younger days.
Absolutely. And so they haven't talked about it, but Lake Mead, I hate to think of where all the dirt's, I guess Glen Canyon Dam, for better or worse, has stopped us from filling up so fast, but
right.
There's still a ton of sediment up there.
Right. Yeah, there's an amazing amount of sediment that comes in the Little Colorado River. the whole basin is moving.
Absolutely
fascinating. Let's talk about the compact for a minute. What do you see as some of the real flaws with the compact, and what needs to be done about it?
Well, I guess to start with, it basically says we're going to use every drop of water, and so it encourages people to use as much as they can. With the thought that, you know, we don't want any water to ever go without being used.
Okay.
And then secondly, it doesn't include the tribes, which are obviously a major component of the whole thing.
Right.
I'm being interviewed for this biography. But do you need me? Sharon, do you need me? Okay. So, I mean, I guess those are the major flaws I see. I mean, I think it's as far as trying to apportion it in some ways, it's probably inevitable, but the fact that you would, and then, of course, you're apportioning more water than there is. So that obviously creates from get-go a major, you know, looming problem.
Right. I mean, you've framed it well. In theory, if we're going to follow the first in time, first in right, the indigenous tribes of the West are first in time and first in right, except they were left out. So that has to change. And then the concept of use it or lose it, we got to use all this water all the time, pushes us to an edge, which is really easy to pass. And then we have way more demand for water than we have water for. So the whole thing is just seems a pack of cards that's very unstable.
Yeah, and again, I guess I can kind of see how it came about, but the other day, somebody's just go back to the drawing boards and start again and rethink the whole idea and then try to figure out how to sell it. But that's where ignoring the fact that Glen Canyon Dam never should have been built and trying to drain the lake and recreate Glen Canyon, getting rid of Glen Canyon Dam enables you to rethink it.
It's funny, Tick. It kind of reminds me of the problems that the Nevada legislature has with the vested interests of the state. And when we have vested interests that say, well, I got mine and good luck to you, then these problems persist and they get worse and worse. And I'm just not clear on the way ahead.
Well, yeah, that's why the great thing about, you know, this climate change and the current drought is forcing decisions.
Right. And I guess California has said, well, we're first in line in this paradigm we've been running for 100 years, and so keep giving us our water and good luck to the rest of you.
Which honestly is good for me, because that means let as much water go down as you can.
Right. But you've got Las Vegas to be thinking about. That's thirsty, certainly in the summer.
Yeah, and you know, we get 300,000 acre feet, which is really nothing, and we could certainly reduce that. But the problem we have is that everybody here is convinced that we're going to be able to, you know, pay California to desalinize or something and get more water. And that's what I've been trying to say is, don't count on more water. Start looking at limiting growth and living within your means.
Right. Yeah, desalinization is so difficult because you end up with a lot of brine, a lot of waste product that has to go somewhere, and that can easily hurt the aquatic environment if you just dump it back in the ocean. And then you've got to get that water that you purify with a lot of electricity to make it happen. You got to get that back out to the users that need it, who are typically far, far away. So it's a complicated technology that has some real interesting dilemmas to it. And what do you think it's going to take to get the southwestern United States to consider drinking within their needs, within their limits?
Just the drought. I mean, at the end of the day, it's there's just not enough water. As you see the lakes go down, you know, again, we can get rid of Lake Powell, which will give us more water, at least for the south.
Right.
But and there's lots of water wasted, lots of agriculture that doesn't need to be agriculture. So, and we have lots of flexibility. But at the end of the day, people need to start realizing that it's overallocated, and the simplest way to deal with that is to use less up above in the upper basin and let as much flow down as you can.
Yeah. And I sure don't see the Front Range of Denver saying, well, we need to cut back on all these new subdivisions. And I don't see Vegas doing that for that matter either.
Right.
I don't see California doing it. I don't see Arizona doing it. I certainly don't see Utah doing it.
Well, Vegas is the first one that's going to do it because we, you know, we can see when our water runs out. So.
Wasn't there a move to get water pumped to Vegas from central Nevada?
There was, and that at least for now has been stopped.
Okay.
Yeah, that was initial thinking was we'll just go up and do like LA did, go up to the Owens Valley. We were going to go up to northern Nevada and pump a bunch of water and pipe it down. And at least for now, we've killed that.
Okay. All right. Well, the neat thing about killing something like that is it does force engineers to look at how to purify our wastewater back into drinking water with permeable
although
barriers.
But what we do is we do the same thing. Always we pump it all back into the lake. So every time we pump a foot out of the lake, we pump 6/10 of a foot back in.
Okay.
So it's and let the lake basically do that work.
Right.
I wouldn't want to be downstream from us, but it's small enough amount that it's not going to kill anybody, but it's still pretty crazy.
Does Vegas try to remove its pharmaceuticals from its water, from its wastewater?
Not to my knowledge, but we do a very good job of cleaning up. I don't think we go that far.
Okay. I think that technology is coming, but I could be speaking out of turn too. So just pondering that in the world of water, wastewater treatment, because that's a scary issue as well, and the impacts of pharmaceuticals to aquatic systems is becoming more real. Kind of watching that. Are you still practicing now?
I have a law office and I have a couple of cases, but not really.
Okay. All right. And are you writing? What are you doing? How are you passing your time?
This job I have as a county commissioner is really just a full-time job. It could be three full-time jobs. There's so much to do. So it's very fun, but it's overwhelming in a lot of ways.
When did you leave the legislature, and when did you get into being county commissioner?
I ran first time in 2018, and just ran again in 2022.
Okay.
So it's again term limited 12 years. So arguably, I could finish this term and run for one more.
Okay. How many commissioners are in each county?
I'm not sure I think it varies by the size of the county, but we have seven.
Okay. And what county are you in?
Clark County.
Okay. What's the district that you're responsible for?
Again, old Las Vegas.
Okay.
It's right in the, pretty much the center of town. I have half the strip but what's fun about it is it's what's called an unincorporated Clark County, so there is no city. And so I'm the city council person, I'm the mayor.
Huh.
I'm the direct elected official for most of the 300,000 people I represent.
That's absolutely fascinating. Because when I think of Las Vegas, I think of, well, it's a fairly large town all the way south, down toward Boulder City and north up to the military reservations up that way and west over to the Charlestons, isn't it? And east basically to the lake. That's a huge area.
Yeah, but even though it's called Las Vegas, it's not, most of it's in unincorporated Clark County.
Absolutely amazing. All right. No wonder you're a busy man. Huh. What are some of the issues you're dealing with as county commissioner?
You know, everything from potholes to garbage to airport to right now the biggest issue is really homelessness, crime. But you know, like right now, the Oakland A's are trying to move here, so we're trying to, you know, if we can afford to bring them. And lots of big hotels open it up. But, you know, it's just, you name it, we're doing it. And, you know, growth doesn't pay for itself, so we try to maintain the roads and everything.
How do you do that? Because Nevada doesn't pay taxes, does it? How does that work?
Very tough. You know, we don't have income tax, so we have a pretty high sales tax. But the hotels pay tax, but they pay less tax in Las Vegas than any other place. They have gambling as a percentage.
I would think it would be in naively speaking here, I would think it would be the casino's best interest to make sure that the city didn't have potholes and had working schools and utilities and transit systems and all that stuff, so that the visitors, I think, second only to Mecca, moving people in and out of Las Vegas every year, would operate smoothly.
Well, that, you know, the airport, anything for visitors, we do. But when you talk about schools, that's not visible to the visitors. So schools are underfunded. There's lots of things which are not that the hotels can certainly pay more and take more care of.
Yeah, because that's their employees that have kids that you know need their kids to be able to get the good schools and get a good education. You know, they're going to be looking at that.
You would think, but the reality is these hotels are mostly based out of California. Worry about their stock price. They don't worry about the
interesting
kids, the people they employ.
Interesting. How do you think that should be changed? I mean, these are some you're dealing with some really huge issues. Not just water for Vegas.
Well, I mean, you name it. We could charge more for water and use that to help schools. We could raise taxes. We could raise gaming taxes. We could raise property taxes. There's just a zillion things we could do to generate more money, to pay teachers more, to do the things we need to do. But again, it takes 2/3 of the legislature to pass a tax. And so we don't have the votes, and the Republican governor right now wouldn't sign the bill anyway. So we're kind of in a catch-22.
Wow. Kind of scary thought there. It's fascinating. It just makes me think about water. It's the same deal where we have a lot of demands on not enough water, and there's no way to squeeze more water out of the desert. So if you have a governor that's not gonna sign a legislature, not gonna sign a bill has to have 2/3 of the legislature. Not gonna get that either. You're right back into watching the infrastructure crumble. Whether it's our cities or our water. Challenging times.
Yep. But that's why it's fun.
I'm glad you think so, and I'm glad you're doing the job you do. Yeah. Well, Tick, I think we might be coming to the end of this interview series. Is there anything else you want to bring in that I have not asked you?
Well, you haven't talked about it. I don't know if it matters, but you know, I did with John and his partner, who I can't think of his name.
Is that Owen? Owen Lammers?
Yeah, Owen. I don't know if it's 2013 or 2015, but I had what do they call them? Anyway, it wasn't a binding law, but it was a statement of resolution, I guess. So I proposed that in 2001 of the years, my first year I met him. And we had hearings and you know, talked about Glen Canyon Dam and why it needed to go. And then we had the hearing, but it never got passed. Or they passed the committee, I can't remember the bailing. So So then came back the next time and had the bill, did the bill in the assembly, where it passed out of the assembly, then came to the Senate, and then we couldn't get it passed. But I did try to, I did have some hearings on Glen Canyon Dam and the need to at least study getting rid of it, which I think was the first time any political body had dealt with that issue.
So the legislature was entertaining a motion to study decommissioning.
Right.
Excellent. Excellent. And it did not pass, then didn't pass the Senate.
Right, but it did pass the Assembly, so we didn't actually get one body of our legislature to pass it.
Right. Right, which was earth shaking right there.
Yeah.
How big was the gap in the Senate?
Yeah, we never got to a vote. I mean, basically, the water district came up and told leadership to squish it. So
oh.
It was told that was a no-no.
Huh. Okay. I wonder if now's the time to revisit that.
Well, in the legislature, we could probably do it. The problem is, in Clark County, where I am now, I couldn't get the seven people, four of us, to do that. You know, we're too tied into the developers and everybody.
Okay.
But the truth is, at this point, I mean, now I'm more working with John on and we're having that, I wouldn't call it a conference, but last two years we've had like seminars or meetings talking about, you know, raising the issue about doing it at the same time that the water authorities are all meeting in Las Vegas in December.
Right.
So we're going a different direction, but I think definitely raising the profile.
Absolutely. It needs to be discussed and people need to realize it's fascinating speaking with you about all of the issues that basically are gridlocked, if you will. And the troubles are getting worse. They're not getting better. So
the truth is, I mean, with this new bureau thing, where they're even talking about, you know, drilling a hole around the side of the dam.
Right.
You know, it's the issues are here. So
yeah.
So I mean, this year is going to postpone everybody for a little bit, but. You know, they say that one good year, even a couple of good years, is not going to make up, be able to fill those two lakes. So it's not going
away. Yeah, and it's short-sighted to even with three or four good years, it would be short-sighted to say we're done with this, because we're not. And if good years are really good, like the paleo floods, the whole system will come unglued. El Centro, 13, what is El Centro? How many, 40 feet below sea level? There would be a 40 feet deep, you know, Salton Sea there.
Plus Glen Canyon Dam might just blow.
Exactly. And what would that do to Hoover and the whole water system? So we're kind of in a very Goldilocks spot where, you know, can't be too hot, can't be too cold. And if it is, we're in trouble. Yeah. So just, you know, looking at new models and ways to, get around these constructs of the past absolutely need to be done. Yeah. Anything else on your plate, Tick, that you want to mention here?
No. I wouldn't say exciting, but it is exciting that things that I and a lot of other people thought would eventually happen are happening now.
Yeah,
it's pretty amazing.
No, it's
So I would say that the conversation is termed, or at least what I've been trying to say, is it's not should we get rid of the dam, but when will we get rid of the dam?
Right. And I think we as a society, when when the shoe pinch is hard enough, we sit up and pay attention and figure things out. Unfortunately, it takes a while for that shoe to actually pinch. And,
let's wait and see.
Yeah, yeah. Excellent. Well, Tick Siegelblum, I want to thank you so very, very much for taking the time to go through these five interviews with the Grand Canyon Historical Society Oral History Project. And thank you for your service.
Well, thank you for being interested. So hopefully someday someone will read this stuff or listen to it and say, oh.
Well, 50 years from now, they'll be really irritated with me because I didn't ask you more about one thing or another. Why didn't he ask Siegelblum? Had him on the phone. Why didn't he ask him about XYZ? Oh, the moron. These things I worry about. All right. Well, with that, this will conclude part five of the Grand Canyon Oral History interview with Tick Siegelblum. Today is Sunday, March 26th, 2023. My name is Tom Martin, and Tick, thank you so very much.
Thank you. If you ever get to Las Vegas, let me know.
I'll do that. Hang on.